Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover and supporting your independent bookstore. We are honored tonight to host The Oatmeal, who also has another name, Matthew Inman. And he will discuss and sign his new book. According to his biography, his official biography, he lives in Seattle, subsists on a steady diet of crickets and whiskey, enjoys long walks on the beach, gravity, and heavy breathing through his mouth. I believe this is his fifth book, so I'd like to welcome him back.
Thank you. Yeah, thanks. It's good to be back here. I always get a really big turnout in Denver. It's nice. Bigger than Seattle, and that's where I'm from. So thank you, Denver. I'd like to start off by saying Happy Columbus Day. That's nice. That's exciting. Love that guy. He's the best. My inbox today was so funny because mostly it's support, but like one out of every 10 people was like, there was one guy, he said, all you liberals deserve to die of Ebola because you hate Columbus. And I was like, well, okay, that's one opinion. That's not my opinion. Normally what I do is I get up here, and some of you have been here before, I talk about some of my favorite comics and where they're coming from. Today, I want to go through a comic I'm working on. It's not done yet, and kind of want to talk about it. And that's it's inspired by a trip I took to the Galapagos Islands about 6 months ago. And I am going to talk about running and mantis shrimps and whatever oatmeal stuff you want to talk about afterward. But in the interim, I'm going to talk about Charles Darwin and the Galapagos Islands. And this comic is supposed to be titled Poor Darwin. And like I said, it was inspired by my trip down to the Galapagos, which is an island chain off the coast of Ecuador where Darwin came up with the idea, or at least collected evidence which he used to come up with the idea for the theory of evolution. I always like to start with a quote from Charles Darwin's father. This was from Darwin to his son when Darwin was 9 years old. The quote reads, "You care for nothing but shooting, dogs, and rat catching, and you will be a disgrace to yourself and all of your family." It's funny, too, because every time I read that quote, I keep reading it, "You care for nothing but shooting dogs." And I picture Darwin, like, hunting Pomeranians on his property. And he didn't hunt Pomeranians, though. So Darwin had dad issues, I guess. Eventually, he went to med school with the hopes of becoming a surgeon in order to kind of make his dad happy. During his first live surgery, surgery back then, there wasn't any anesthesia, nitrous oxide. So anesthesia was kind of like bite down on this. And during the surgery, the guy's screaming and wailing, there's blood spraying everywhere. And Darwin was like, fuck this, I'm out. He was out of med school. He was done. Decided to study divinity instead, went into the church. And that's what he did until he was 22 years old. Charles Darwin, at the age of 22, that's when he set sail with Captain Robert Fitzroy on the HMS Beagle on his voyage that would later form the theory of evolution. So a lot of people picture Darwin, they picture this grizzly old man with a big white beard. But actually, he was a 22-year-old man when he went on his famous voyage. And the ship captain who invited him was 23. So it was kind of these two young guys who did it. The ship captain, Captain Robert Fitzroy, invited Darwin for two reasons. One, he wanted a buddy. He wanted somebody he could talk to, and he thought Darwin was a charming guy. Reason number two, and this is actually true, he invited Darwin to be on him on a ship around the world for 5 years because he liked the shape of Darwin's nose. He thought he had a really nice nose. That's why he chose him to be his buddy for the next 5 years. Their official job on this mission, this voyage, was to chart the coastlines. That's what they were paid to do. Fitzroy's real goal, with a real reason he wanted to go, he was a very devout man. He wanted to find actual evidence of biblical creation in the South American jungle. So he took Charles Darwin to find proof of Jesus in the jungle, which didn't really end up working out that well for him. when I went to the Galapagos Islands, it's an amazing place. There's all sorts of critters there you can't see anywhere else in the world. There's penguins that swim in bathwater, warm water, and you can go diving with them and all that kind of thing. And I went there because I kind of wanted to sort of relive Charles Darwin's voyage, in a sense. I wanted to go to the islands he went to. I wanted to see the animals that he saw. And we had a naturalist on board our ship. And we go into these islands, and the naturalist would point at things and talk about the islands and how they were formed. And I was really disappointed with her ability to talk about anything relating to evolution. And I don't know what that was about. Maybe it's because Catholicism is so deeply rooted in that area of the world. Like for example, the kind of the primer that Darwin used to solve the key of evolution, or what he uses as evidence, was finches. They're these little brown birds. They're called LBBs. Nobody gives a shit about them because they're little and brown. The finches had beaks that were specifically evolved to match the fruit and food on different islands. And so if it had a long, almost like a proboscis on a mosquito, it usually would drink honeysuckles. If it had a beak that was like a short saw, usually it would feast on succulents, cactuses, things like that. So I'm on the island with this glorified tour guide, and I'm trying to get her to talk about the finches. I'd be like, where are the finches? Show me a finch. And she's like, I don't know. Maybe that. And it's like a fucking seagull. It's a seagull. I'm like, that's not a finch. That's not it. So finally we see some pink flamingos. And of course, everyone on the boat's losing their minds. Like, oh my God, it's a pink flamingo. And they're taking fucking Facebook photos. And I'm like, those are shrimp with wings. They are irrelevant. Where are the finches? They're not even from here. Take all the flamingos and barbecue them. I don't care. I want to see some finches. So my trip was disappointing. I wasn't reliving anything Darwin was experiencing. It was, that was a letdown. Darwin, however, was a seasick man. He didn't know this until he set foot on the Beagle, and a day later he realized he barfs all the time. So Darwin actually barfed all the way from England, all the way down the tip of South America, all the way back around, all the way across the world, back to England. I actually think he barfed on more animals than he discovered on that voyage. And I remember I don't get seasick either, but for some reason, when I was in the Galapagos, we spent a lot of time in the water, and we were in a very fast boat at times, and I started to get seasick a lot. And I remember one night, it was like a beautiful moonlit night in the middle of the Pacific, and I was just ralphing into the sea. It was gorgeous, and it was painful. And I remember thinking, this is how I'm connecting with Darwin, like over hundreds of years through stomach acid and chunks of pineapple into the sea. Darwin was sick a lot, too, other than always being seasick. He had even after he returned home from his trip, the voyage of the Beagle, he was just constantly afflicted with headaches, nausea, drowsiness. He was just a miserable, sick man. He ended up seeing 30 doctors. No one could figure out what was wrong with him. A lot of different suspicions about what was wrong. Some people think it was psychosomatic, that maybe he made it up. The most popular theory, and the theory that I think is probably the most realistic, was that he had what's called Chagas disease, which is a very, very specific affliction that comes from a very specific bug, and it's called a kissing bug. And it's like this kind of little beetle, or it's a pretty big beetle. It's got a long, long nose or a long mouth, and they call them kissing bugs because what they do is, while you're asleep, they climb on your face, they get on your mouth, and they bite you in the mouth. And they do that because they're drawn to CO2. So when you exhale, they can smell it, and they go over, and that's why they bite you on the lips. That's why they're called kissing bugs, which is innocuous. You get a little sore there, but it's nothing terrible. What does become a problem is some of these bugs, what they like to do is as they're biting you, they also like to poop. They like to bite and poop. So they end up pooping in the wound, and then you get Chagas disease, and unless it's treated, you are basically sick for the rest of your life. And Darwin, there's this anecdote in his journal about how he found one of these beetles, and he thought it was adorable because he's weird, and he loved bugs, and he kept it as a pet. And he described feeding it every couple days where he'd let it sit on his finger and bite him. So I'm in the camp that thinks Darwin gave himself Chagas disease while he was on a trip in South America. And his relationship with bugs was weird. Another example is the bombardier beetle. Charles Darwin interacted with one at one point where, I don't know if you've heard of the bombardier beetle. Basically, it is a beetle that has a Gatling gun in its butthole. It has chambers that cycle, and when these chambers combine two separate fluids, it forms a caustic acid that sprays out of its ass at 500 rounds a second and heats the acid up to 200 degrees Fahrenheit. It's used as a defense mechanism, so if another bug attacks it, it just sprays out its butt. And it's an amazing, amazing insect. And it's funny because a lot of creationists like to cite the human eye as a source of intelligent design because saying it's too complex to have evolved. But the other thing they like to cite is the bombardier beetle's butthole, which I thought was funny because it's like someone saying, you know, that butthole, there's no way, you know, God made that butthole. It's so complicated. There's no way it could have evolved. It's a very sophisticated butt rifle. So Darwin, at one point, he was out bug hunting and he's walking in the jungle, and he spots this amazing, beautiful beetle he's never seen before. So he picks it up in his left hand, and he keeps walking, and then he's continuing his bug expedition. He sees another bug, and he picks it up in his right hand. He's just so excited. He's got these two bugs, and he's walking, and finally he sees this third beetle that is just the most wonderful beetle he's ever seen. He's so excited to collect it. So he takes the beetle in his left hand, and he puts it in his mouth. How? And then he picks up the third beetle, and the beetle he threw in his mouth was a bombardier beetle. So, of course, it you know, fired his butt off, sprayed him in the mouth with caustic acid, and he spat it out. And that's how the bombardier beetle was discovered, which is funny considering the fact that creationists now use that as an example of intelligent design. It was the bug that he put in his mouth that sprayed him. It didn't harm him, but again, it was just another example of Darwin having the weird shenanigans with bugs. And he's sick all the time with Chagas disease, and he's throwing, of course you're sick, you put fucking bugs in your mouth. That's what happens. You put bugs in your mouth, you get sick. That's rule number one of being a human being. Don't put bugs in your mouth. Don't do it. It's bad. I know it's tempting. Babies love to eat spiders. They love it. They go crazy for it. I always keep spiders in my pocket. In case I'm near a baby, I know how much they love spiders. I give them some spiders. Just kidding. I hate babies. So I don't give them anything. I've been on like a bug kick lately where I don't really want to read anything else. I don't want to read about dinosaurs. I don't want to read about space. I just want to read about bugs. Bugs, bugs, bugs. Like, it's my whole world. And my latest fascination is with what's called a Brazilian wandering spider from Brazil. They're also called banana spiders. And there is a banana spider in the United States in the South that have little yellow legs, look like bananas. Those aren't the same as the Brazilian wandering spiders. The Brazilian wandering spiders are very large and they're brown. And they're very different from most spiders in that most spiders, they spin a web and they hang around in that web until food comes by. And then they eat it. You know, then I actually, for the most part, they're pretty harmless, even if it's a venomous spider. I mean, I don't remember the last time anybody's been bitten by a spider. It's very, very rare. And most of the time when someone is bitten by a spider, it's actually usually something else. It's usually just a rash or a pimple or whatever the case may be. So I actually, in my house, if I see a spider, I leave it alone. I let it go there. I call them mall cops in my house because they kill fleas, ticks, mites, mosquitoes, all of it. They kill everybody. They protect me from other things. So I just let them run amok. I pour spiders in my bed. I pour them in everything. It's great. If you guys ever want to spend the night, I got lots of space. You just be covered in new friends while you're there. It's wonderful. Brazilian wandering spider, banana spider, is not like that. They don't spin webs. What they do is they stay in banana trees, they drop to the ground, and they run, and they take things down. They actually call them horse killers in Brazil because they are just as venomous as a black widow. The difference is they inject 10 times as much venom into your body if they bite you. So it'd be like being bitten by a black widow 10 times in the same location. It's the most venomous spider in the world. They're incredibly aggressive. I have an entomologist friend who was in Brazil and actually encountered one, and he's like a bug guy. So he's the kind of guy who picks up everything for the most part. And when he saw the Brazilian wandering spider, he had a broom. He's like, get the fuck away. And he was doing one of these. And it ran up the broom handle. Like, that's how aggressive they are. It's bad. And they actually, what they do is they rear up on their back legs, and they put their two arms, and they kind of do one of these. They actually rear up. And when they do, you can see their underbelly. And to kind of exacerbate the horror of a banana spider, their underbelly looks like a vagina. It looks like a vagina, and not a good one. It's an orange vagina. Orangish-pink vagina. It's bad. Like, if I've seen some vaginas, and I know that's not the right color. So just imagine you have a broom and there's a murderous vagina running up the... It's the worst insect I could think of. And there are stories in Brazilian villages of banana spiders dropping from the trees at night and running into villages to jump on things. It's just horrible. And the final kicker with the Brazilian wandering spider that I can't quite decide if it's a good thing or a bad thing is if you are a man and you are bitten by one of these and you don't have access to the antivenom, you will die. You will asphyxiate, cardiac arrest, paralysis, so you slowly, you know, become unable to move and unable to breathe. It's a very, very painful death. During those hours of agonizing pain, you will have what's called priapism, which is a persistent erection until you die. So it's like a, I don't know, like I've weighed the pros and the cons on this, and I think it's a good thing, because boners are usually a good thing. Like, nobody's like, damn, I got a boner. It's more like, yes, this is nice. But it's not like you're using it, you know, and it, from what I read, it hurts when you have priapism, so that's not so good. On the other hand, though, I look at it as like you're dying and you're leaving this world, and it's just like a final wave goodbye to the air. So, yeah, anyway, I've just been into spiders a lot lately, like I said. Another one of my favorites is it's called the Australian widow. It's a redback. It's fairly innocuous. They're venomous, but it's on par with the black widow. The reason they're interesting is the female actually has two vaginas, and she's massive. It's extreme cases of sexual dimorphism where the female's the size of a bus and the male's the size of a scooter. And the male, he's developed this sort of behavior where typically when he mates with her, she'll eat him because she wants the protein. It's very common. It's one of the many cases of sexual cannibalism that occur in nature. And so kind of what happens with the male is he will actually run up, inseminate in one vagina, if possible, run to the other one and quickly as fast, like, try to inseminate that one and run away before she gets him. But over time, the species has evolved so that some of them, the male's behavior, what he does is he runs to vagina one, he runs to vagina two, and then he actually does, he doesn't walk, he doesn't run, he does a front flip and lands in her jaws upside down for her to eat him. He just is like, my body is ready, just eat me. Like, I'm not gonna play this game with you, I'm not gonna run, you're making babies, I got tons of protein in my body, let's just combine. So it's kind of sweet in a way. It is a shit deal for the male, although it kind of balances out. The males actually have a behavior where they can be just as wicked, where oftentimes the males will seek out a juvenile who isn't reached sexual maturity yet. So she actually doesn't have a spider vagina. She doesn't have one yet. It's not there. It's still, I don't know, growing or whatever. I don't know how that works. So what he'll do is he'll actually run up to her, and while she's not looking, he'll kind of sneak in, and he'll bite her a new vagina, and then he'll shoot his stuff into there, and he'll run away. And as she grows older and becomes an adult, she is already pregnant. So by the time she actually reaches sexual maturity, she's already pregnant from his little secret ninja sexy times. I got to come up with a better word for that. But yeah, anyway, I like spiders. I don't know. They're pretty great. It's funny. I always hear people complain about online dating. It's, oh, it's so hard dating in your 20s. And like, spiders are like, watch what they have to do. It's just, you know, you have no reason to complain. At all. So yeah, back to Darwin. He was sick a lot. He was a miserable guy. Captain Fitzroy, his companion, who was so enamored with his nose, turned out they didn't really get along after a couple of days, so they were stuck in this tiny cabin together for 5 years. Fitzroy was temperamental. He threatened suicide every couple of days. He's like, I had it! It's over! I'm gonna kill myself! He's a very sad, crazy guy. And his uncle had slit his own throat, and the previous captain of the HMS Beagle put a gun to his head mid-voyage. So it was kind of a cursed voyage for that guy. And Darwin at one point discovered a new dolphin species while he was down there. And he actually named it Delphinus Fitzroy. He named it after Captain Fitzroy, which I thought was odd. I figured he'd pick like a stomach parasite, considering how much the two fought. And I'd like to think it's because their personalities were similar. I mean, Fitzroy was a very devout man, but also a very troubled man. And I just like to think of these dolphins off the coast of South America bounding through the water, these suicidal Jesus freak dolphins just bounding around. But yeah, after 5 years, they ended up going to the Galapagos Islands. Darwin saw a bunch of stuff, took a lot of notes, did not come up with the theory of evolution there. He just took a lot of notes and took a bunch of stuff home. He actually had a habit of eating every single species he discovered, too. So anything he discovered, if it were a tortoise or a bug or a bird, hum, 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 it was just this thing. I think maybe he wanted to absorb their powers and he could fly home or something. I don't know. So they went home. Got back to England, Fitzroy and Darwin sort of gave each other the bird and walked their opposite ways, and that was the end of that. And Darwin waited 5 years before he finally wrote a 230-page essay outlining his theory on the survival of the fittest. And after finishing it, he took it and he threw it in a cupboard and didn't look at it for another 15 years. So this thing sat there for 20 years, completely unused. Instead, he decided in the next 15 years, he married his cousin, he fathered 10 children, and he spent 8 years working on a new book about barnacles. 8 years. 8 years on barnacles. Yeah. That was a good waste of your 30s. And he submitted it to his publisher. They, for some reason, published it. Nobody cared. Nobody read it. 1 star on Amazon. And Darwin's exact quote when asked about the book is as follows. I hate a barnacle as no man ever did before. That's 8 years well spent, buddy. Good job. So after 15 years of barnacle study and cousin marrying and kids and stuff, he got a letter from a colleague, kind of a colleague, a fan, who independently had come up with the same idea he already had. The difference was he had the evidence, he had the finches, he had the tortoises. So Darwin basically said to him, look, I've already done this, but you came up with it. He's like, I'm destroyed. And they kind of mutually agreed to present the idea together, which was nice. There was not a lot of backhandedness there. So Darwin's like, let's present this as a group. And they did. And, unfortunately the day the press conference was called, where they actually submitted Darwin's theory of evolution, Darwin's favorite son died that day, so he was actually burying him. Or he died a few days prior, so he was actually burying him the day that his theory of evolution was presented to the world. So in addition to bugs and all the horror and vomiting, I'd like to reiterate, you know, poor, poor Darwin. Eventually, though, he did get it together in book form, and they submitted On the Origin of Species to a publisher, and the publisher denied the book outright. And the exact words from the publisher for denying Darwin's book, which basically defined survival of the fittest and everything that we know about evolution, the rejection letter, my favorite part, is as follows. Write a book about pigeons. Everyone is interested in pigeons. Poor Darwin. Eventually, though, he did find a publisher, and it was one of the fortunate few where he received fame, fortune, and celebrity in his lifetime. He published it. It was an instant success. He was an overnight sensation, with that, though, came a lot of controversy because it's evolution, and that draws a lot of ire from the religious right, and Darwin kind of became a bit of a hermit. In addition to being sick all the time, he was a very shy man, a very quiet man, and he actually installed a mirror system in his front door, so he never had to go outside if he didn't want to, or see visitors who showed up. At some point, the scientific community, all the great minds of the time, held a public debate to decide unanimously whether Darwin's theory was good, or if it was bad, if it was true, or if it was false. And it was this big, loud affair, and everybody was there. And midway through it, from the back of the room, this guy starts walking up the aisle, holding a Bible in his hand, saying, "Jesus, Jesus." And like half the room's like, "Jesus, Jesus." The guy was Captain Fitzroy, 25 years later, still pissed off about the Beagle. But after On the Origin of Species was published, he wrote a bunch of other books about all kinds of things. They were mostly successful. That was actually his least big moneymaker. He wrote a bunch of other books about the natural world that actually made him quite a bit of money. His final project, Darwin's final gift to the world, was studying worms, and he thought the best way to study them was to play the piano for them. So, racked with pain and illness, alone by himself with a giant fucking beard, he played the piano for worms until he was dead. So, once again, poor Darwin. And that's the end of my Darwin talk. Thank you very much. And this is a running book, so I do need to talk a little bit about running. So I'm just going to talk briefly about that, and then we can do a couple questions, and then we can actually assign some books. I started running about 10 years ago, and I was working two jobs at the time, both of them sitting in front of a computer, and I grew up kind of a fat kid, and then that kind of went away when I was a teenager, but in my early 20s, I was basically just living in front of a screen. So I started running because I just wanted to get out of the house and feel active. I didn't really have a goal in mind. I wasn't trying to run a marathon. I wasn't trying to lose weight. I just wanted to feel better. And that's sort of how I got started with running, and that's how I still run. I run to feel better. My body doesn't really change. I don't post on Facebook about what I ran. I don't really run for vanity. I just run because it makes me a nicer, happier guy. And that's sort of been my philosophy throughout the years. For example, my family, I go visit them for Thanksgiving, and we're all crowded in this little house in the woods, and I go running, and they're all so like, "Oh, that's so admirable. He's running. He's burning off those calories." And what they don't realize is I'm a horrible dick if I haven't gone running, and I'm cranky, and I'm miserable, and I want to escape them. So it's like the only way that I can get out and appear active. It's weird. It's like a socially acceptable drug addiction, except, you know, instead of getting riot cops and strung out in prison, you get energy gels and shirts and medals. So it's a good addiction to have. The blurch came about because when I started running, I couldn't run very far, less than a mile. And I would run and stop and run and stop. And I kept setting these waypoints. Like, okay, there's a stop sign. There's a Pomeranian being chased by a naturalist with a gun. There's whatever. And if I didn't reach that goal, I always envisioned this overweight sort of version of myself from when I was a kid would catch me, and I would become him. And that ended up evolving the idea of this character, of this little cherub who chases me and tells me to watch Netflix, who tells me to eat the entire cake if I can, if no one's watching. Actually, I was originally going to call it the Blorch with an O, but my sister, her baby throws up all the time, and she calls it blorching, and there's the verb she uses. And he's always throwing up sour milk. He just produces sour milk. It's like a sprinkler of sour milk around the house. So I had to say blurch instead of blorch. I ran a lot. I kind of Forrest Gumped it. I didn't run at all, and then I went from not being... The last time I'd run was in high school when they forced you to run a mile or something. And I went from that into running 7 days a week. caught the running bug and kept up upgrading distances. I do this trick where rather than getting fast at one pace, like, oh, I can run a really fast 5K or half or a full, I just keep adding more miles, so it's continually impressive, even though I'm not actually becoming a better runner. Like, it's like I did a 10K, or I did a half and then a 10K, and then I did a couple of sprint triathlons, I did half Ironman, full marathon. And every time you upgrade the distance, like, oh my God, that's amazing. But if you shave off 20 minutes, your friends and family who don't run, they're like, okay, so that's harder then? Like, it's just, it's a way of cheating. And that's what I've been doing. Because I'm not very fast. I'm not really good at anything with running. I just sort of go out there and plod along. My fastest mile actually was set. My brother and I were on a training run, and it was an out and back. And it was a long out and back with not a lot out there. And at the turnaround, I think it was a 9 mile turnaround. It was an 18 mile run. At mile 9, I took a goo, and it was the first and last time I ever had an espresso flavored goo. And my body, you know, when coffee goes into it, it's like sounds the alarm to blow the airlock. It's like the alien queen is at the right part of the ship. Hit the button. And so that's what happened. And I had to go, and we're out in the woods, and there's nowhere to go. So I just started running faster and faster and faster because I'm going to shit my pants in front of my brother. And he's like watching his watch. What are you doing? This is an 18-mile run. Why are you running a sub-6 mile? I'm like, oh, my God. So finally, I encounter a Baskin-Robbins, and I'm like, there's a toilet in there. I know it. I know they have toilets in those places. So I go in, and there's a line of people getting to get their ice cream, and I don't want to just butt in front of them. And the guy making the ice cream is very, like, into his thing. So I'm waiting for the line to dissipate. And I'll never forget these kids. It was these little kids. It was like one of them was like 3, and the other one was like, who gives a fuck? And they were these little kids. And I call them Travis and Chad, and they were little fuckers because they were taking too long, and I had to go to the bathroom. And these little fuckers were choosing their ice cream, and they're Rain Manning away trying to figure it out. I'm just like losing my mind. And finally, they get through the line. They get their shitty ice cream, and I come up to the guy, and I've been rehearsing in my head, like, what I'm going to say. Like, okay, so act cool. You don't have a wallet. You don't have any money. You're not buying ice cream, but you really need to use the toilet. So I'm just like, I get up and do, like, the word vomit thing. Where you're like, so I'm a runner. I run a lot, and I have to go, but now. And I'll buy ice cream at some point in the future. I'm a responsible citizen. I used to have a cell phone. It's in the car. Like, just saying too much. And the guy's like, it's right there. Go. And so I go and use his bathroom and, you know, do the worst things imaginable that you can do to it. Defiled it, destroyed it, and it was loud, it was terrible, and like Christopher Nolan's directing a movie about what I did to that bathroom, I think. But yeah, that was my fastest mile. I think that's my biggest race achievement, actually, was Baskin-Robbins, so I think I'm going to end on that. Thank you very much. And we'll do a couple of questions, and then we'll sign books. Do you have anything to ask? Yes. Oh, that'd be great. Yeah, yeah. There's a few runners with me here too that were in the race, so cookies would be wonderful. Yeah.
What's your source for the Darwin?
That came from Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything, most of it, and then it was corroborated by a book by Amy Stewart. Yeah. Great question. Okay, yeah, so...
peanut butter and bacon.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Peanut butter and bacon? Is that what you said? Oh, that's delicious. It's got dead animals in it and dead plants. That's great. Any other questions? Yes. I thought about going into video and animation, but I kind of like comics better right now. I don't know. I had some interest from a TV network about making a history science show, according to The Oatmeal. I just don't know how I translate that, or those are cookies, that into an actual animated series. So we'll see. I had one idea where I sort of do what I'm doing here, but with, I normally have slides and stuff that I've drawn, and try to turn that into like a Comedy Central 1 hour Oatmeal teaches you about Brazilian wandering spiders. But I don't know. So, yeah. Yeah, no, I get that a lot. It's the comics are funnier when they're drawn that way. You know, they look like obese, bald, frog-eyed baby people. It's better. So, I was saying this during the I was running today with some people from here, and I was saying that people who get into cartooning, humor cartooning, you know, they're like, okay, the first thing I need to do is learn to draw. I'm going to learn to draw the human hand. And it's not really. It doesn't really make a difference. The punchline is actually funnier. The more, you know, the more sparsely it's drawn. If you want to get into graphic novels and make Batman, obviously, you know, learning how to draw is important. But with the oatmeal, less is better. Yeah. Well, I mean, the internet's a good medium for it. Anything you make, just put it on the internet. You know, there's an endless supply of people who can read it, who can comment on it, who can inspire you, who can ruin your life, depending on what they write. The most important piece of advice is, like, page one, chapter one of Scott McCloud's book, Making Comics. And he talks about get the right drawing materials, which are anything that he writes and a piece of paper. And a lot of people early on, they get so kind of, you know, caught up with, oh, I need this perfect pen or this perfect tablet or this perfect software to get into it. Start as crudely as possible. I mean, I always tell people to use crayons and sticky notes. That way, if it looks like crap, it doesn't matter. You can focus more on making it funny or making it original or making it compelling, and you don't focus on, like I said, making a hand or drawing feet well or something like that. So, yeah, crayons, the internet. That's my answer, in short. Yeah. I drew when I was little. Yeah, my brother and I used to have these, my mom used to bring home butcher paper, rolls of it, and my brother and I would take a black pen and a red pen and draw these massive battles with stick figures, just killing each other with spears and swords and stuff. And it was very creative, and we loved it. But by the time I was 13, I got my first computer, and I just lost interest in art altogether and focused on just being a software developer. And it was kind of a shame because I didn't really draw at all until I was like 20, 23, 24, and I started the oatmeal when I was 26, I think. So instead, I don't know, I didn't waste that time, but I think I'm much better at this than I ever was as a software guy. So, yeah. Yeah. They found me. Yeah, I think they wanted to find whoever is the best, someone who's public who knows stuff about Tesla, and then there was a video of me shooting a friend of mine with a Canon. The Where the Hell's Matt guy, Dancing Matt, I was shooting him with it. So I think they found that and ended up getting a hold of me. So, yeah, that interview was funny too, because I spent, I pretty much spent months like researching, because it's for the History Channel and you have to know what you're talking about. And the interview was 40 minutes long and all we talked about was the history of the electric chair and what burnt arm hair smells like on Henry Rollins. And like, I way overdid it. Like, I learned the history of I could build you an electromagnet out of this thing right now. It would create lightning. Like, I learned everything just to be sure, because it's the History Channel. So I kind of wasted, I don't know if I wasted time. I did not need to know that much about lightning bolts. Like, I know way too much about lightning now. So, we'll do the right here. Yeah. Like I said, I was a programmer. And I was, I only have a high school education, so my grammar abilities were pretty much on par with a high school kid, which isn't bad. But then when I started writing comics and writing blogging, I suddenly found myself in a position where I had to learn a lot of the rules of grammar suddenly. So I'm good at learning, taking things that are large body information and making it presentable. You know, like making something as boring sounding as a mantis shrimp into something that's really, really compelling. Because most people, if you say the word mantis shrimp, they're just like, they assume it's just this, you know, undersea bore or something. So with grammar, how do you make a semicolon fun and interesting? So that would be kind of became my task. I still don't really consider myself much of a grammar expert, though. Like, I'm not really a grammarian, and I don't know. I wanted to do a comic about commas at one point, but I just figured out that the rules are so complex, and there's so many different, and it's very, commas are emotional, is that the right word? Like, everyone's got their way of doing it, and if you mess with their way, they, you know, have problems, so I leave it alone. Yeah, I don't know if I'll ever do any more grammar comics. I don't know. I've moved on to other things. I got banana spiders now, so. We'll do, yeah, two more questions in the very back. Yeah.
You have a real
Sorry, rephrase the question. I was thinking about spiders for a second. I'm serious. What did you? I heard veterinarians, and I'd never do that on stage, but I started thinking about stuff, and I was like, there's a light. And then I realized, did you say, do I have experience with veterinarians?
Yeah, your own experience with your pets, and your veterinarian knows about your work.
Oh, yeah. Well, the first I had didn't. She was a dick. So I went to a new one, and I hated her. She wouldn't even look my pet in the eye. I was like, look at him. Look at him in the eye when you're talking to him. But then the next vet, I actually was in the waiting area, and they had a tile of cats plotting to kill you in the magazine thing. And I was like, all right, this is where I need to be. So I don't know if it makes a difference, but like I had my newest dog, I had her spayed about a year ago, and I kept thinking, the fact that they know who I am, I feel like maybe they'll be a little bit more on point that day. Because, you know, when your dog goes to have surgery, it's a very terrifying thing. Like, I kept thinking, you know, bring your A-team to the vet office that day. Don't be hungover. Have lots of coffee. So I hope that if they know the oatmeal, they'll take better care of my dog. Because if my dogs die, which they won't because they're luckily immortal, I will burn the sky down. I mean, I will kill everything and everyone to make them suffer as I have suffered. So we'll do one final question, and please don't be who would win in the fight. Yes? It changes a lot. Lately, I've been reading Death Bulge. It's great. It's disgusting and horrible. Nobody knows about it. Death Bulge. That's been really, really good lately. Formal Sweatpants, I'm a big fan of. Older stuff would be, well, that's not a webcomic. I was just going to say The Usuals, you know, Farside, Calvin Hobbes, that kind of thing. Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal is a really good one, and he's actually consistently updates, which is nice. You don't have to wait once every 6 weeks for a comic like you do with some people, so. But I think that's it, so thank you for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.